Group meeting, Sunday, October 30th, 1983. I have tried during our meetings this year to introduce the idea of total relationship with life, a complete relationship. This means that we could be free from the limitations imposed by acceptance on the one hand and rejection on the other hand. And this freedom is really necessary if each one of us is to have the opportunity to realize full humanity, our full human nature. Acceptance comes about because we have likes. We like something, it appeals to us, we accept it. Rejection comes about because we have dislikes. We dislike this, that, or the other, and we want to get rid of it or destroy it. But that implies that we are constantly in a state of conflict. We are never in a state of harmony, of true harmony. Therefore, it becomes important for the person who is concerned with that sort of religious living which enables the full fruition of humanness to come about, it is important that we should be free from both acceptance and rejection. Of course, this will immediately raise the problem, do we accept good? We accept good, of course, and do we accept evil also? You will find that when one's own consciousness has evolved to that point where it is capable of being awake to everything that happens in the world, then there will be no problem of accepting goodness and rejecting evil. Simply because the totality contains both. This is the point. It is we, constituted as we are, and functioning as we do with our particular type of psychophysical organism, we have these reactions which we pigeonhole as pleasant or unpleasant, good or evil. But when one's consciousness has evolved to the stage where it is at one with the total consciousness, then there is no question of acceptance or rejection. Everything is. And everything that is undergoes constant change, perpetual change. And that change, we can well have a faith in this, ultimately is directed towards complete fruition in the transcendent sense, not in our sense. You see, we pick and choose because of our likes and dislikes, because the constitution is such. The physical body itself depends entirely upon its pleasure-pain mechanism in order to live healthily and as a decent human being. It depends upon that. So we are, by virtue of our constitution, we are constrained that way. So we pick and choose. But all preferential choice in the long run has to dissolve away, that is the personal preferential choice, and then the transcendent activity which goes on without our knowing it will function unhindered and bring about full fruition. Whether we do it in our lifetime or not, it doesn't matter. We are so concerned with ourselves. We want to do the right thing, the best thing. We want to get to heaven. We want to get to nirvana. And we want to have the right beliefs and ideas. All that is nonsense. It really is. And it is extremely difficult to come to the point. It's intellectually very distressing, but it is very difficult to come to the point where we can see the fact as the fact. The whole fact, not the particular fact out of the context of the totality. This is very, very important. Now, science, religion, and the newspapers, they have at least one unhappy effect upon us. They deprive us of mental freedom, of the freedom of the mind. They condition us. You see, people say, oh, but it is scientifically proved that this is so. And when a person says that, he more or less implies that this is the absolute truth forever and ever. There'll be no change. Now, this is false. Everything changes. If you look at the history of science, you will see how it has undergone extraordinary changes during the last 25 to 30 centuries. Extraordinary changes, right from the beginning. And in our own century, the changes are simply phenomenal in the outlook upon the nature of things and upon the destiny and future of man himself. So much for science. Therefore, it is unwise to take scientific authority as the final, as the arbiter of the final truth as such. There is no such thing as a final truth which is expressible in terms of the perishable. All our thoughts, our philosophies, our doctrines, and all the rest of it, they all are perishable. They come into being and they pass away. What is imperishable is the ultimate source itself, whatever that source may be. When we try to define that source, we begin to make our mistake. Because we, being creatures of definition ourselves, naturally will limit that definition in our terms. You look at the conceptions of God that have come into existence for the last 10,000 years, if you like. They are just the person himself glorified. That is all. We talk of God in terms of the absolute good, absolute love, absolute tenderness, absolute care for us miserable little creatures, and so forth. But all those conceptions are false. They cover up the truth of a reality which is so transcendent that it is inexpressible in concept and in word. This we must bear in mind. You will find that all our conceptions of ultimate reality are nothing else but ourselves glorified through the ages. That has been the case. This is where a study of comparative religion is quite helpful. So you see, we must bear in mind that we believe what we want to believe. It pleases us. We like the idea. Take, for instance, the simple fact of teachings like rebirth and karma as popularly presented and believed in. One part of the world accepts that. Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism too, I think, accepts that. But great religions like Zarathustrianism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they have no belief of rebirth and karma involved. You see, and they have flourished, and they will continue to flourish. So will the Hindus and the Buddhists. They will continue to flourish with their beliefs, their ideas. But it is conceivable that a time may come when they will say, oh no, what we believed in then, the form in which we believed it, is a mistaken form, and therefore it is wise to relinquish it. You see. Now, in this connection, let us look at something that we find in the Gita. I myself entirely reject the popular presentations of rebirth and karma. They are hopelessly inaccurate and untrue. They are not only misleading, but they have become responsible for many of the unfortunate drawbacks which we find in the Eastern cultures. It tends to make you put things off. Oh, well, in another life we will do this, that and the other, you see. They won't do anything. And they assume that they will be there. They don't understand the actual fact that the existential being, the psychophysical being, in Buddhist terms, the shape or body, the sensations, the feelings, the thoughts, the different mental conformations and discriminative consciousness itself completely perishes. There is no such thing as an I am I persisting life after life in another body. Now this is one of the very troublesome and difficult things in the East, particularly in the East. And of course it's spreading to the West too. More and more Western people are beginning to accept this idea of rebirth. Why? It pleases them. It pleases their intellect and it pleases their feeling of self-preservation. I shall continue forever and ever. God help the universe if I shall continue forever and ever. You see, think of this dispassionately, not from the standpoint of a fixed belief. Now, what has religion done then? It has presented this idea as a fact, and it has acted as a hindrance to realizing greater and greater freedom. If you have true freedom of mind, certainly not in the sense of I do what I like, that is the very thing that has brought about immense misery in the world, I do what I like. But real freedom of mind, which enables you to inquire, to challenge, to investigate, to explore, and let the discovery of reality take place. The truth will reveal itself to you. You can never go and grasp the truth and say, I'm searching for the truth. Ah, there it is, I've got it. Nothing of the sort will happen. But if oneself remains calm, quiet, pure, completely pure, bodily, emotionally, mentally, then the truth will reveal itself. And it will not reveal itself to your brain. It will reveal itself in this way, that it will transform your consciousness, your mode of awareness of all existence and of the reality. When that change in consciousness takes place, then there will be changes in your brain itself, and you will think thoughts and you will see principles which are in line with the natural evolutionary process, both materially and spiritually. See, this is the important thing to bear in mind. All right. Now let us see what Sri Krishna said. It comes in the sixth discourse. He that performeth such action as his duty, independently of the fruit of action, he is an ascetic. he is a yogi, not he that is without fire and without rites. That means just the ceremonial processes of the Hindus. Isn't that so? The fire and the rites and so forth. All right. Independently of the fruit of action, that means personal desire is out, isn't it? You do something not because you want to get a certain result. Personal desire is completely out. He is an ascetic. What is an ascetic? Not a person who tortures himself in any way. In the 18th discourse, I think the 17th or 18th discourse, Krishna says outright that he who tortures himself, well, he is rather a silly ass. And the Buddha taught precisely the same. He who lives without tormenting himself, without tormenting others, lives as a person who has become Brahman, the Supreme, the Absolute. So asceticism really means freeing yourself from all that is unnecessary in your life. If you have 100,000 pounds or something, it doesn't mean you should give it away like that, sir. You are a trustee for that. Utilize it in the right way, the perfect way. And you will know the right and the perfect way if you yourself are free from selfness. Completely free from all selfness. Then you will see how to use that thing. It will come to you quite naturally. So an ascetic is a person who has freed himself from all that is unnecessary. And he is a real yogi, which means that his consciousness is completely at one with the total consciousness. You see, consciousness is not a state of mind. States of mind and ideas and concepts and so forth are expressions of your innermost state of your innermost consciousness. And that is something which is invisible to us, and it is unknown by the brain, that innermost consciousness. That innermost consciousness is the actual touching by transcendence of you. It touches you there in your innermost consciousness, but you don't know it. You can't see God and survive. You can see God and not only survive, but be wholly yourself if the complete purification takes place. Then the organism is prepared to stand the tremendous power of transcendence as it flows into you. Otherwise, you would break under the strain. Now, that which is called renunciation, know thou that as yoga, O Pandava. Now, that is how Krishna puts it. I said the ascetic is one who gets rid of all, is free of all that is unnecessary. This renunciation really means being free of all that is unnecessary. That is all. Nor doth anyone become a yogi with the formative will unrenounced. Then let us go on. For a sage who is seeking yoga, action is called the means. For the same sage, when he is enthroned in yoga, serenity is called the means. That complete calm, that blissful calm, when you are utterly dispassionate, you don't grasp at anything, you don't run away from anything also, you see, then they are really serene, you are completely balanced. When a man feeleth no attachment either for the objects of sense or for actions, renouncing the formative will. The formative will means, you know, planning for yourself, sankalpa, your own desires and so forth, upon which the intellect works and plans how your desire shall be fulfilled. That's your formative will. That's your sankalpa. When you have finished with the formative will, then you are enthroned in yoga. Because the formative will is entirely self-centered. You may say, oh no, I am seeking God. How can you seek that which you don't know? If you say, I'm looking for my kettle, I know I put it somewhere in such and such a room, and you can go and look for it. And when you see it, you'll recognize it. When you see God, will you recognize God? Have I the power to do that? Not at all. See, I am just an existential mortal. How will I recognize that which is the eternal, transcendent, immortal? You see, we human beings are really not very wise. And the major part of the world's population is really extremely foolish. Look at history. All the way through. Really foolish. Now, let me go on to this problem which Arjuna raises. He who is unsubdued but possesseth faith, with the mind wandering away from yoga, failing to attain perfection in yoga, what path doth he tread, O Krishna? Fallen from both, is he destroyed like a rent cloud, unsteadfast, O mighty armed, deluded in the path of the eternal? Deign, O Krishna, to completely dispel this doubt of mine, for there is none to be found save thyself, able to destroy this doubt. Now listen to Krishna's answer. The Blessed Lord said, O son of Pritha, neither in this world nor in the life to come is there destruction for him. Never doth any who worketh righteousness, O beloved, tread the path of woe. Having attained to the worlds of the pure doing, and having dwelt there for immemorial years, he who fell from yoga is reborn in a pure and blessed house. Or he may even be born into a family of wise yogis, but such a birth as that is most difficult to obtain in this world. There he recovereth the characteristics belonging to his former body, and with these he again laboreth for perfection, O joy of the Kurus. By that former practice he is irresistibly swept away, and wishing to know yoga, he goeth beyond the word to the realization of Brahman. That is what Sri Krishna said. There was no such person as Sri Krishna. Nor was there, well, there may have been, probably was, a person called Arjuna. But there was, there may be doubts about both Arjuna and Krishna, but there was someone who wrote the Gita. That is why the Gita is available, it is here. Isn't that so? Now, who was that someone? He is named as Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa. You see? That is his full name. He wrote the Gita. Now, what happened to him that he was enabled to produce a Gita? He himself must have been a very remarkable yogi. The author of the Gita, I'm talking of. And if he was a perfected holy one, which I presume he was, in fact I would definitely affirm that he was a perfected holy one, he was capable of entering into those deep states of consciousness where he reaches the ultimate limit which is possible for human beings to reach. He had, to use the Christian term, he had realized the Unio Mystica. To use Buddhist terms, he was able to enter into the cessation. To use Hindu terms, he was able to enter into the Turiya state of consciousness. The Turiya consciousness. Now this means that your consciousness is no longer your consciousness. It is at one, completely at one with that one and only total consciousness, which permeates the entire universe. You are not lost in it, nor have you gained it, neither of those things. You have become integrated in that. Your consciousness has become integrated into that. It is an integral part and parcel of the totality, altogether, the material as well as the spiritual. So that is the supreme state. Now, when the yogi comes out of that state, as indeed every single yogi had to come out of that state in order to continue to live, because the body must be fed ultimately, it must sleep, it must eliminate, and so on and so on. So therefore he has to come out of that state. Usually they could stay up to 6 or 7 days and nights absolutely quietly in that state. But beyond that it was unwise to stay in that state because something which they didn't know in medical terms as we do now, their nitrogen balance, their nitrogen metabolism would have been completely upset. And they were wise enough not to overreach themselves. Now, when they come back to ordinary consciousness, which means functioning through the operation of the senses and the logical activity of the brain in conceptual terms and so forth, certain thoughts and feelings and words arise as a result of that experience. But the existential being, the author of the Gita, like any one of us now, in those centuries, was conditioned by the climate of thought of his day. Now you see, the climate of thought of those days was one in which they believed in rebirth and karma in the usual sense in which it is presented. You see, they couldn't see that the existential being, the psychophysical organism, completely dies. And then they say, well, what remains? Nothing remains which you can get hold of. This is the point. How does the psychophysical organism come into being? The transcendent itself, the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, which is also at the same time pure, absolute consciousness, which is also fundamental substance, nothing to do with substance in our sense of the word, it is immaterial altogether, which is also everything in potentiality which we see manifest in the universe now. That primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, by self-constriction, goes through various grades of manifestation till finally it produces this physical, this cosmos that we know of. You see? With a very big bang, he does it. So you see, that transcendent energy, that transcendent consciousness, completely permeates and interpenetrates all things that are manifest. That is the one without a second, as they say in the Upanishads, Brahman. That is the one. But that one, in totality, in its totality, completely permeates every separate thing in manifestation. Now, I must take responsibility for saying this. This has not been taught anywhere or said by anybody. I think I'm the first person who has said this. That is why there is this immediacy of transcendent activity in the calm. No disturbance in it. You see? It is a calm activity of transcendence through each and every one of us, through each and every atom throughout the universe. You see, if you like to consider this by yourself in the quiet, you will find some very remarkable things happening in your own consciousness, which will give you extraordinary freedom. Extraordinary freedom. So many problems, so many difficulties will fall outside altogether. In our lives, we know how we get hurt by those who are dear to us, and so forth. Why do we get hurt? Not so much why as how do we get hurt? How is it that it hurts us? We being what we are, have certain expectations from husband, wife, child, parent, friend, employer, employee, and so forth. We hold hard to these expectations. We grasp these, and according to them, we demand that the other shall behave this way and that way. If the other doesn't behave this way and that way, well then, I shall be hurt. But you see, fundamentally, it is I who am making the mistake of expecting and demanding. Why can't I let be? Supposing I have two sons. Fortunately, they're not bad boys. They're boys of 40 now, over 40. But supposing one of them was a bad fellow, as the world calls a bad fellow. If I understand him, my acceptance of him will be complete and total as the acceptance of the other. I have no favorite child or somebody whom I love more than another or anything like that. Absolutely none. Everyone is the same. There is this extraordinary equality. You find it in Mahayana Buddhism come out, this sense of equality. In one of the, what are they called? The fancy now. Me forgetting that. What is the term used in Mahayana? John, do you know? There are six or seven of them.
The paramitas.
So they are presented as like archangels, Ratnasambhava and all the others. The bodhisattvas, yes, you see. Yes, that sort of thing. It is there too. There is this, one of them represents the complete equality of everything. You view everything as part and parcel of yourself and part and parcel of the totality only, you see. And you don't make any differentiation. Then you will find that you won't get hurt. But there we are. Ultimately, we must look into ourselves to see where am I wrong or where am I short of some ability or virtue or whatever it is which makes me suffer because somebody is behaving like this, that, or the other. You see? So now, Sri Krishna gave the teaching in accord with the climate of thought of his day. And that climate of thought has survived in the East right up to our own day. But you see, if you were to inquire, not challenge in the sense of challenging as an opponent who is out to defeat you, not in that sense, but challenge anything and everything that is said. Challenge everything that I say. Don't believe it. Because it will only bind you. I say this. I have seen this. Therefore I say it. You see, but just accept the word as the word, and if you are interested, if you care to do so, meditate on it and see what happens. And then according to what happens for you and something emerges for you, that is your truth for the time being. And you have to live by that. And as you live by that and proceed to live in this manner, then gradually enlightenment comes. You see, this is very important. So now, these words of Krishna were suitable for his day and age. I would say that they are entirely unsuitable now. Because when Krishna is saying that you are born again and again, and Krishna says in the second discourse, I remember all my past lives, O Arjuna, you don't, you've forgotten, but I remember. Now, there is a way of making out that as a true statement. Look, when you, the yogi, when you, the perfected Holy One, enter into the profoundest state of consciousness possible to human beings, and you are one with the totality, then there is no separate him, her, you, I. There is no such thing. Every single person is myself. And every single person is me. You see? In that totality of consciousness, which includes all humanity, past, present and future. That is why the Buddha too, I say that is why, of course, all the Buddhists will disagree with me. But that doesn't matter. You see? I say that the Buddha used, when the Buddha said, Ananda, this is to be understood. He tells a story of a king and queen in the past and so forth, or whatever the story he tells. Again and again this occurs. And he says, Ananda, I was so-and-so. Yasodhara, his wife, was so-and-so. You were so-and-so in that story. Now you see, when your consciousness completely includes everything and everybody as yourself, it is perhaps quite legitimate to talk in those terms. I today, in the 20th century, would say it's quite unnecessary. It's quite unnecessary. Be free. You see, this is the sad part of the story. Science and religion exert an extraordinary authority over human minds, which they just shouldn't do, really. So, if we understand these things, you will see why Krishna answers in those terms. Arjuna represents the author of the Gita himself in his ordinary everyday state. That is what Arjuna represents. Krishna represents the author of the Gita in his transcendent consciousness state. And that is how the author reproduced. I say that is how the Old Testament prophets are presented, you know. And the Spirit of the Lord moved Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezra or whoever it was, and he said. What is the meaning of the Spirit of the Lord moved? What is this Spirit which comes and moves anybody? It is just you yourself in that state of consciousness, nothing else. It's not like a super whiskey or something like that, which intoxicates you divinely. There is no such thing as a divine intoxication. Our word enthusiastic is often translated as God intoxicated. Enthusiastic. It's not a case of God intoxication. If it is, then that person would be wise to keep his mouth shut. Because what he will say will not represent the reality or be in touch with it. So, I hope this is of some use to you on this rather difficult and important matter, beliefs. Now, I mentioned the newspapers, so I'll finish off with the newspapers. You know how people say, oh, but I saw it in the papers. That's accepted as truth. It was in the papers that the Prime Minister said so-and-so, did or said so-and-so, and the Home Affairs Minister said it, and all the affairs of the cabinet, which are kept secret for 30 years, the record is kept of what actually happened, and after 30 years it is allowed to be published. In the meantime, the newspapers have been saying 1,001 different things about these ministers and so on. And when you read the actual published record 30 years later, you will see that practically all the statements of the newspapers were false. Humbug. So you see, the tragedy is here. That is, these things influence the minds, the behavior of the population as such. And so much misery, sorrow, difficulty unnecessarily comes along. The population should learn to be ascetic, be free of all that is unnecessary. And then the whole situation will be different. But the truth is what will make you free. And the truth only you can discover for yourself. You have to be free of all preconceptions, all assumptions, all prejudices, and be well aware of your own biases. Every single existential being, the psychophysical organism, is born with its own natural bias through heredity and evolution and so forth. Now, we have to become aware of that bias. That is our personal responsibility. And if we become aware of that bias and understand how and when that bias functions and affects your life, then you will be free from the limitations and the miseries that that bias will bring about. And it will also enable you to bring about the good things with which you are naturally born. You may be a Beethoven, a Shakespeare, somebody wonderful, see? So that also has the chance of coming out. Thank you.